in Israel. Every loss of life should be treated the same way. And I don't think, as a physician, I've been in crisis areas, in disasters for the past 12 years. This is the worst I've seen. And I'm really fearful for the Palestinian people and the children that have no connection to what happened in Israel. They're not responsible for what happened in Israel. The situation is beyond catastrophe. And I urge our government, because they are the only party that is able to stop this hell that is raining on Gaza.
President Zaha Salul, I want to thank you for being with us. President and CEO of Med Global, speaking to us from Chicago. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a video news production fellow. Learn more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Noreen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warinoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tay Marie Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Sanji Lopez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of the Día de los Muertos celebration on Wednesday, November 1st, from 12 to 10 p.m., at the Red on Salmon Street in Portland. Día de los Muertos is an ancient celebration originating from the indigenous people of Mexico. Festivities will include altar creation, muertos face painting, sugar skull decorating, traditional Mexican food, and live musical performances. Again, that's the Día de los Muertos celebration on Wednesday, November 1st from 12 to 10 p.m. at the Red on Salmon Street. 831 Southeast Salmon Street in Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Tune in to Higher Reasoning Reggae every Sunday morning at 3 a.m. Higher Reasoning Reggae is dedicated to bringing international reggae word and sound power to the massive airing early Sunday mornings at 3 a.m. Only on KBOO Portland.
Support for this program comes from KBOO members and Fat Cupcake, with locations in Oregon City, Happy Valley, and a new location in Southeast Portland. Information at fatcupcake.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, Kaiser Healthcare workers represented by SEIU reach a tentative agreement after their three-day strike. Common Cause rates Oregon's redistricting process at a C-. And Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson releases emergency funds to address homelessness. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 13th, 2023. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. Kaiser Healthcare workers represented by SEIU Local 49 say they've reached a tentative agreement with the healthcare giant after a three-day strike at the beginning of the month. 75,000 Kaiser workers across the country walked off the job for 3 days in protest of staffing shortages and low pay. It was the largest healthcare strike in U.S. history, made up of nursing assistants, lab staff, and other workers. The strike caused disruption at Kaiser facilities, with some medical and dental offices closing for lack of staff. The tentative agreement means that both bargaining teams, the union and the management, have come to an agreement that they're satisfied with and will each have a chance to ratify. SEIU workers will vote on whether to approve the tentative agreement, and if they do, that becomes their new contract. This deal doesn't cover pharmacy workers at Kaiser, who are also on strike and could be until October 21st. They're represented by UFCW Local 555, and they face many of the same difficulties that SEIU Kaiser workers do. Patients will likely still see closures at pharmacies and delays in filling prescriptions until the strike is over. The national organization Common Cause published their grading on how states around the nation performed on redistricting after the 2020 census. Their analysis was based on community feedback to the redistricting process, when the state must redraw electoral boundaries for state and federal elections. Common Cause gave Oregon a C-. They found there wasn't enough outreach to different communities, especially tribal communities in the state. In particular, the map the state settled on split up the Warm Springs Reservation from the city of Madras. Madras isn't on the reservation, but it is the city where many tribal members live, shop, and go to school. In the previous map, the two were kept together. Tribes felt that their feedback on the maps wasn't really taken into account. This has given energy to a 2024 ballot measure campaign to create an independent citizens redistricting commission in Oregon, something other states have. One of the future lessons Common Cause takes from the redistricting process in Oregon is that it must respect tribal communities' sovereign status and commit to engaging them with meaningful outreach. Oregon's overall score was a C-, but that's still a passing grade. Other states didn't fare so well. Common Cause gave Illinois' redistricting an F. Mark Richardson has the details on what went wrong.
A national watchdog group studied how all 50 states handled the biennial process of redrawing their congressional district lines and has given Illinois a failing grade. Common Cause issued its report this week, analyzing how effective each state has been in drawing fair, independent, and balanced district maps. Only two states, California and Massachusetts, earned an A, while 17 states were in the D or F category. Dan Vicuña, National Redistricting Director with Common Cause, says there was a consistent thread among the states that rated poorly.
The states that ranked near the bottom shared some things in common, which included a lack of transparency and an unwillingness to give the public much or any notice about when meetings would take place, having redistricting hearings for the public during traditional working hours.
The report says Illinois was a near-perfect model for everything that can go wrong with the redistricting process, but state legislature scheduled hearings in places and at times when many people could not attend. The report says the result was heavily gerrymandered in favor of Democrats, which drew lawsuits from a half dozen civil rights groups. Vicuña says to improve the process, Illinois needs to develop a nonpartisan system or commission with broad representation to draw up districts, hold well-advertised hearings in public places after work hours, increase language assistance, and improve access for people with disabilities.
States that find a different path and take that power away and create citizen commissions, create bipartisan, multipartisan processes for drawing districts, keeping political insiders boxed out of the process and making redistricting community-centered has resulted in great success.
Vicuña says Illinois lawmakers drew congressional and state legislative districts through the legislative process, using it in this cycle to protect the Democratic supermajority. Reformers have twice put ballot initiatives in front of voters to create independent citizen redistrict commissions in the last decade, winning both times. However, both laws were subsequently struck down by the Illinois Supreme Court. For Illinois News Connection, I'm Mark Richardson.
Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson okays emergency funds for homeless services. 2 weeks ago, county commissioners voted on how to spend $62 million in funding to address the homeless crisis. Now, Vega Peterson is using her executive authority to spend the money, awarding emergency contracts to certain service providers. Over $3 million will be allocated to homeless day centers like Rose Haven and Blanchet House. Another $500,000 will be set aside to create another day center in Northeast Portland. This is particularly important as Portland says they will start enforcing their daytime camping ban sometime soon. $16 million are set aside for the mass sanctioned campsites that Portland has planned. There's also funding for building a sobering center and a stabilization center for people leaving detox in downtown Portland. Some of the money will go through the Joint Office of Homeless Services, but others will be allocated through the County Health Department, the Human Services Department, and the Emergency Management Department. House Majority Leader Steve Scalise drops out of the Speaker race. Aid to Israel may be in jeopardy due to the Speaker vacancy, and New Jersey Senator Menendez faces a new charge as acting as a foreign agent for Egypt. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This country is counting on us to come back together. This House of Representatives needs a Speaker, and we need to open up the House again. But clearly, not everybody is there.
Representative Steve Scalise has withdrawn from the race for Speaker of the House, but will remain Majority Leader. The Louisiana Republican struggled with little room for error. The GOP four-vote margin makes the position of every member crucial, even that of scandal-plagued New York Republican George Santos.
We're going to have to find someone else in leadership that comes forward that's going to be a compromise candidate. But as for me, it's never for Scalise.
Chair of House Foreign Affairs Michael McCaul warns fellow Republicans the politics and disorder around the Speaker vacancy is a dangerous game that tells adversaries democracy doesn't work.
So I see a lot of threats out there, but one of the biggest threats I see is in that room, because we can't unify as a conference and put a Speaker in the chair to govern.
McCaul is pushing an aid package for Israel, but says his hands are tied. Nothing can pass the House until a new Speaker's chosen. Some lawmakers are now pushing for acting Speaker Patrick McHenry to keep the job temporarily, with another government shutdown fight probable next month. Some progressives are getting pushback over their responses to the Hamas attacks. Democratic Representatives Rashida Tlaib and Cori Bush are calling for an end to all Israel aid. Democratic Maryland centrist Denny Hoyer says he doesn't agree, but also says people who call Tlaib a terrorist for displaying a Palestinian flag are wrong.
I disagree with some of her comments. She lamented the death on both sides, and I think she condemned, I don't have her statement right in front of me, but she condemned terrorist activity.
The White House says so far about 30 Americans have died in the war. Democratic New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez faces another serious criminal charge, an accusation he acted as an unregistered foreign agent for Egypt. Back in 2019, Menendez accused former President Donald Trump of being a foreign agent for Russia.
They deserve to know if Donald Trump is wittingly or unwittingly an agent for the Russian Federation.
In a Florida campaign speech, Trump expressed frustration with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Trump even praised the Iran-backed group Hezbollah, calling them very smart after they fired an anti-tank missile at the Israeli army. Former Wyoming Representative Liz Cheney responded on social media asking Republicans if they would actually nominate someone that dangerous for president. A new $6.4 billion bond issue in California will fund thousands of behavioral health treatment beds and tens of thousands of outpatient slots. Governor Gavin Newsom says it'll modernize their mental health and substance use treatment.
Society becomes how we behave. We have a responsibility to shift this paradigm.
Finally, the Social Security Administration says beneficiaries will get a 3.2% bump in their checks next year to help buying power keep up with inflation. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Back in 2019, Oregon passed Senate Bill 1008, which abolished life without parole sentences for juveniles. Now, North Carolina is debating whether to end life sentences for minors, too. More than half of the states in the U.S. have already done so. Striving for a balance between justice, accountability, and youth rehabilitation, they're emphasizing the importance of scientific insights into brain development and criminal justice. Shantia Hudson has more.
Over half of U.S. states have already banned life sentences without the possibility of parole for juveniles. North Carolina isn't one of them yet. In a panel discussion with the North Carolina Task Force for Racial Equity and Criminal Justice, Republican Representative John Hardister of Guilford County says he backs the need for a scientific approach to address the issues of youth development and criminal justice.
There needs to be retribution and punishment and so forth and justice when certain crimes are committed, but if the brain is not fully developed, I think we have to take that scientific fact into account.
Many advocates argue that a sentence without the possibility of hope or incentive for self-improvement for the young offender falls short. But critics of ending the threat of life sentences voice concerns about the impact on victims and public safety. Also on the panel, North Dakota GOP Senator Diane Larson highlights her state as an example of banning juvenile life without parole sentences. With unanimous approval of legislation in 2017, Larson says North Dakota has prioritized the role of the parole board and eliminated the possibility of life without parole.
We all think that people who commit terrible crimes should be held accountable. They should be answerable for their crimes. But there needs to be some opportunity for them to grow up, learn from what they've done, make better choices.
Formerly incarcerated at 16, panelist Anthony Willis spent more than 2 decades in a North Carolina prison for murder. He received clemency from Governor Roy Cooper and offers his own story as a testament to the power of change. Willis believes the possibility of eventually going home serves as a powerful motivator for people behind bars, thus fostering a safer environment for prisoners and staff.
As a teenager, it's very hard to go to prison as a child. Everything that you were taught from your parents, that goes out the window. It's a totally different culture while you're in prison. And you don't really have that guidance, that mentor, that person to try to help you to develop into an adult. So if you have a life without parole sentence, there is no incentive at all to do the right thing.
Willis and others said the key to North Carolina changing its juvenile sentencing practices lies in considering all parties, focusing on rehabilitation and determining the resources needed for successful reentry. For North Carolina News Service, I'm Shantia Hudson.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $55,000 by the end of October. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. That's your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 57. Tomorrow's weather will also likely see some rain showers and a daytime high of 63 degrees. Today in history, in 1941, American singer-songwriter Paul Simon was born. He's had a 6-decade career and is one of the most celebrated artists of the 20th century. The quote of the day is from Simon, who wrote in the song The Boxer, quote, "A man sees what he wants to see and disregards the rest." Indigenous protesters have taken to the streets in Guatemala to rally against attempts to block a reformist president-elect from taking power. With that story and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas from KMBA in Anchorage, Alaska, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. As the Guatemalan government prepares to use force against the unprecedented uprising led by indigenous groups, thousands of citizens in that Central American country are still joining actions against what they see as attempts to block a reformist president-elect from taking power. Maria Martin reports on the second week of the uprising against corruption and authoritarianism in Guatemala.
Busloads of new protesters entered Guatemala City this week from the largely indigenous provinces of San Marcos and Huehuetenango. The protests and the more than 100 blockades across the country are only getting bigger in the wake of recent statements by President Alejandro Yamatei. In a nationally televised speech, the outgoing president said protesting Guatemalans who have virtually shut down the country were, quote, poquitos. There are only a few, Yamatei said, of the hundreds of thousands out in the streets and highways. At the major crossroads called Cuatro Caminos, indigenous TikTok influencers, the Pacheco brothers, sent a message in response to Guatemala's president.
¡Somos poquitos!
We are many, says Rafael Pacheco, and we'll continue to fight the corrupt government. As the protests grow, tensions are rising, and violence has broken out in some places. Outgoing President Yamatei blames President-elect Bernardo Arevalo for, quote, encouraging the protesters. Arevalo, whose presidency many believe Yamatei's government is trying to block, says the government is using infiltrators to incite violence so that it can declare a state of siege. For National Native News, I'm Maria Martin.
Nationwide, millions of barriers like dams make it hard for fish to move freely and lay eggs. Now the federal government is spending more than $200 million to reopen spawning grounds for fish. That includes an effort to recover an endangered species that's sacred to the Pyramid Lake Paiute Tribe in Nevada. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel reports.
At the Pyramid Lake Paiute Reservation in northern Nevada, rolling mountains cloaked in pale green sagebrush unfold for miles like a painting that never ends. Standing at an overlook in these hills is the tribe's chairman, James Phoenix. He's watching the Truckee River rush over Numana Dam, an irrigation diversion. As a kid, Phoenix fished in these waters for kiwi, suckerfish that aren't found anywhere else in the world.
Bringing them to shore and then cutting, filleting them, that was what my dad had taught me, and I got to experience, you know, that's how he was taught when he was young.
The tribe refers to themselves as Kiwi Takuta in their native language, which means the kiwi eaters. But tribal members stopped catching them back in the 1980s as the fish population plummeted. A big reason for the decreased fish population is this dam. It was built more than 100 years ago to divert river water to the reservation for farming and ranching. But it's been a barrier for migration of the endangered kiwi and threatened Lahontan cutthroat trout, another fish crucial to the tribe. Phoenix says the previous tribal council discussed removing or modifying the dam, but kept running into the same hurdle.
A lot of funds weren't available.
That finally changed. The tribe is getting more than $8 million from the bipartisan infrastructure law to modify the dam. The money will be used to build a large underwater ramp, stretching from bank to bank, so fish can swim up and over the dam. The project, which recently broke ground, will reopen 65 miles of river for their migration. Phoenix says that will impact more than the tribe's culture.
It's important to our economics. You know, we rely on tourism and fishing, so we get a lot of anglers that are coming in seasonally, so it's really big for us.
For National Native News, I'm Caleb Radel.
I'm Jill Freitas.
Support for a teacher strike in Portland public schools remains strong. Earlier this week, the Portland Association of Teachers announced that in a preliminary vote, an average of 90% of their members from every school in the district pledged to vote to strike if it came to that. A teacher strike could begin as early as the end of the month if PPS and the union are not able to come to an agreement. KBOO's Isabel Charlet spoke with Angela Bonilla, the president of the Portland Association of Teachers, for more.
The Portland Association of Teachers has been in tense contract negotiations with Portland Public Schools since January. With just two more mediated sessions to go, Angela Bonilla says things are not looking good.
Unfortunately, it's looking more and more like we're going to have to strike for them to take us seriously, because we don't have a teacher shortage. We have a respect shortage. We have a pay shortage. We have a workload relief shortage, but we don't have a teacher shortage. We have people who want to teach but can't do it under these conditions or this pay, and they leave for something else.
Earlier this month, the union released a report called A Manufactured Crisis, where they say district spending on instruction has lagged compared to other budget areas like administration. They say that despite multiple oversight bodies repeatedly urging PPS to address this pattern, PPS still decreased the instruction budget for the 23-24 school year.
Why are you increasing administrators and non-building administrators while cutting classroom teachers? Like, your budget for admin shouldn't be increasing as the folks you manage decrease and the students decrease.
The union accuses the district of a general lack of transparency around funding. For example, after cutting 95 classroom positions 2 years ago and replacing them with non-classroom positions, Bonilla says she never got a clear answer on where those funds went.
But then they said, well, we didn't lose that many FTE. It's because they replaced them with non-classroom positions. And when we asked, okay, well, where did that FTE go? The response was, well, we're not quite sure, but we know it's not classrooms. Am I going bonkers to think that in a school district, the most important position is the position making sure that kids are learning? Because why would you cut those positions and then do what with them? I don't know.
The report also criticizes PPS for giving significant pay increases to administrators that are not keeping up with wages for teachers and other school staff.
And what I saw was their salaries have increased from anywhere between 3% and 10.4% over 1 year, right? And when you look at the custodial scale, for example, for SEIU, in the 2021 year, the highest salary for custodial was $20.31 an hour, right? So we're seeing that there's money to get the most qualified candidates for certain positions, but woe is us, there's no money, there's no way for us to do that when it comes to the folks who directly impact the experience of students.
The union is demanding an 8.5% pay increase for teachers the first year in order to catch up with inflation, followed by a 13% pay increase over the following 2 years. The district has countered with a 3% increase for the next 3 years.
But as the largest district with the largest piece of the pie, why can't we get the things we're seeing other districts get? And those are the questions we've been asking, and we keep being dismissed.
The union's report also says the district is holding on to nearly $100 million, well above what they are legally required to have in reserve, that could be used better elsewhere.
So it could look like additional staff. It could look like additional pay. It could look like increased salaries for our partner unions. So like our paras, our EAs, our nutrition services, our custodial, like there are so many schools where we have issues because it's the ripple effect of no one being funded appropriately.
Another sticking point is class size. The union is asking for classroom size caps, and when those are not possible, to pay teachers for extra planning time. I was not able to get an interview with someone from PBS for this story, but their official response to the union report says that the numbers the union is citing are incorrect. They say they would need to hire 500 new teachers in order to meet the classroom caps that the union is asking for, and they do not have the funding to meet the union's demands for pay increases or other safety concerns.
That communication says to me that they do not plan on compromising or finding a solution, that they are prepared to push us to strike, which is a bummer because I'd rather be with kids. I'd rather be at school teaching.
The union and the district have their second to last bargaining session tomorrow, and Bonilla is feeling hopeful about the outpouring of support for Portland's teachers.
We have increasing PTA solidarity letters going to the superintendent and the school board. We have electeds writing solidarity letters to the superintendent and school board. I have students emailing me saying, we want to set up a solidarity club to support teachers if they go on strike. How can we do that?
That was Angela Bonilla, president of the Portland Association of Teachers. And for KBOO News, I'm Isabel Charlet.
Whales and other marine mammals can be disturbed by underwater sounds, but there's a solution. Bubble curtains can help protect them from the noise of things like offshore wind construction. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. At some offshore wind farm construction sites, loud pile drivers are used to anchor turbine bases to the ocean floor. But underwater noise and vibration can disturb whales and other marine mammals swimming nearby. So Helen Rose Patterson of the National Wildlife Federation says it's important to minimize that noise whenever possible. One strategy is called a bubble curtain. A ship lays a tube on the ocean floor surrounding the construction site. Air is then pushed through holes in the tube to create a vertical wall of bubbles that traps the sound of construction
and help keep it from getting to the marine mammals and causing them harm.
The technology is now being used at two offshore wind projects in the U.S. And there are other ways to minimize noise. For example, by limiting construction when whales are in the area. And Patterson points out that offshore wind is just one source of underwater noise.
Because we have global shipping, we have oil and gas exploration, we have military activities, there's lots of things contributing to underwater noise.
But she says it's important to ensure that offshore wind does not make the problem worse, so the industry can provide clean energy to people on land while causing as little disturbance as possible to animals in the ocean. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 13th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Isabel Charlet, the producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Shantia Hudson, Mark Richardson, Alex Gonzalez, Jill Freitas, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBU programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members, lovely folks like you. KBU is currently in our fall membership drive, so now's a great time to join. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kbu.fm/give or text KBU to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.